So first I should say that I really should be Florence Tama, but I can neither reproduce her French accent nor can take credit for many of the things that she did while she was working with me. 2 years ago when this course was taught, Florence introduced the ideas that she'd been interested in developing, this flexible fitting of atomic structures into EM maps, and many of the examples I'm going to be able to talk to you about today at the end of my talk really arose out of interactions that sprung up from that course 2 years ago, and we continue to be very interested in fostering those kinds of relationships and interactions, and hopefully I'll teach you a little bit about how one can use these flexible fitting methods to explore atomic level structures and their interpretation in the context of experimental data from cryo-EM. I should also say that like NRAM, I run a NIH research resource called Multiscale Modeling Tools for Structural Biology, whose one of their key objectives, in fact, is to produce software and make it available for the community of structural biologists like many of you. And much of the software that I'll either talk directly about or allude to is available from this resource. And we have a collection of strong collaborators, including Steve Harvey, who's here in the audience as a participant, who's been involved and continues to be involved in developing software that's associated with modeling at multiple scales of resolution data from structural biology. So with that, what I'd like to do today is talk to you about approaches that have been developed over the last few years in our center to explore fitting atomic level structures into cryo-EM data. Many of the points that Niels made in his previous talk, I think, are extremely valid and important points about the validity and testing and having some level of confidence of your various models. But having said that, it's also really all about using these models to interpret biology, to interpret new biology in new ways. And of course, this is why the confidence is important, because if you have a completely wrong model and you interpret it, oftentimes your interpretations are wrong. However, it's really about ideas, I guess, is my point. And it's stressing those ideas that are generated by being able to build atomic level models that is really the important component. Now, in my talk today, what I'm going to do is sort of outline the methods that are used to develop this flexible fitting algorithm first, talk a little bit about some of the applications of those to interpreting biological data in the absence of experimental EM maps in some instances, but just to give you some ideas about how the methodology in general is useful. And then I'll move on to talk about the fitting methods and how they use this framework of normal modes to explore fitting into experimental density. So the framework that we're talking about is the elastic network normal mode analysis approach. And this is really a very multi-resolution theory or approach to developing and exploring large-scale conformational changes. I first want to tell you a little bit about what normal modes are, why these elastic network types of approaches that we've utilized are important in the normal mode context, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what the elastic network models are themselves, hopefully. There. Oops. Come on back. Boy. How did you do this, Niels? Thank you. All right. First, several points I want to make about normal mode analysis. So it's true that normal mode analysis basically takes some complex potential energy landscape that corresponds to whatever the system you're talking about a molecule or an assembly, etc., and expresses it in a form that allows you to explore local fluctuations around that one given conformation that corresponds to the minimum energy conformation. So that's a caveat in much of what I'm talking about, but I'll try to address, you know, why that caveat is not so important when one's looking at multi-resolution models. But the other key issues that I want to emphasize are the fact that what normal mode analysis does is it re-expresses the energy cost of distorting the structure in an atomic representation to one which uses a set of very, very collective coordinates. And those collective coordinates have the properties that the lowest frequency modes are the most collective, involving most of the atoms. And so you have a single, for example, variable that expresses very, very global distortions of the structure. Or you have a small set of very low frequency parameters, modes, coordinates, variables in the context of refinement that express very collective and large scale motions of the system. And as you go up in the frequency spectrum, as you go up in the energy cost for distorting the structure, at higher frequencies you get more and more local motions. So in the context of the problem that Niels pointed out with regards to overfitting, in a sense, normal modes, you use really a very small number of degrees of freedom, and I'll emphasize this later on, 4 or 5 parameters or degrees of freedom. And hence, this issue of data to parameters is not as big a problem, and the problem of overfitting is not as large. And in fact, in many of the examples we've looked at, we're using far fewer, well, not far fewer, we're using fewer degrees of freedom to fit EM models in, or atomic models into EM data than are used if one does the sectioning of segments of the structure and refines each of those independently. So the main point here is that low frequencies correspond to collective global motions, and through a range of observations based on experimental data, we've noted that there appears to be extremely high overlap between this very small subset of low frequency modes and conformational changes that are key and responsible for biological function. And so this is something you should take away with yourself, that gee, these normal modes may in fact be very related to the functional motions, and they're very collective and cooperative, describing the distortion of the entire structure. So how do we get normal modes is the next thing I want to address, and as I already mentioned, in fact, it's expressing a very, very complex energy function that describes, you know, how displacing any atom in a very large system might cost, in, what it might cost in terms of energy, about a local minimum in, arrived at by calculating the second derivative of that potential energy function with respect to motion of any two atoms, I and J. Okay, and then the cost here is this is the change in the energy with respect to the variables I of coordinates I and J, and this is the displacements of those coordinates from their initial or equilibrium condition or position. And what normal mode analysis does is take this second derivative problem, this expansion, which is described in terms of the Hessian or the matrix of second derivatives of the potential and the displacements, and finds a transformation which diagonalizes this Hessian and gives rise to a set of a completely independent parameters or modes and corresponding frequencies that equivalently that describe this problem. And those modes have the character that I just described pictorially on the last view graph. That is, some of them, the lowest frequency ones, are extremely collective, involving all of the atoms. The high frequency ones get more and more local. The low frequency ones appear to be, in many cases, related to functional motions of the system. So this is all, you know, well and good. Except if we start to look at systems like the size of myosin or like the size of the ribosome that, Joachim Frank talked about the other day, or some of the viruses that, Tim Baker worked on or Jack Johnson spoke about last night, we realize there are big problems in trying to deal with this many, many dimensional, very, very large systems. This Hessian, this matrix, is of dimension 3n by 3n, where n is the number of atomic centers in the atomic system. That's way big for a virus. That's very, very big for something like the ribosome as well. Consequently, we have to resort to other techniques to describe the energy on distorting the molecular structure. And in fact, we rely on a set of methods or ideas that were developed by Tyrion in the late 90s, 1996, which take advantage of a coarse graining that suggests that when we go on length scales or when we look at distances that are large compared to the average size of an atom, the properties of the molecular structure begin to appear to be like those of an elastic body. And consequently, we can transform sort of a detailed atomic representation to an equivalent elastic network in which we sit on any given atom or any pseudo-atom, center of a residue or center of a group of residues, and draw an elastic bond between all of the neighbors that are within some cutoff distance, which I'll comment about in a moment. And these elastic bonds represent the distortion energy, or the energy of moving the structure away from its equilibrium position, by, again, a Hookean-type spring, ball and spring model. So the advantage of this is that, first of all, we don't have to find a global minimum of this very, very complex energy surface initially to express the energy. The configuration that we believe is the global minimum from crystallography, but may not be the global minimum on our X-ray structure, is perfectly suitable. Moreover, we can coarse grain these models at many levels. C alpha atoms is sort of the simplest and the obvious. And then our overall model then is defined in terms of this sort of Hookean potential with elastic springs between pairs of atoms or pairs of pseudo-atoms or pseudo-atom centers that are dependent upon some cutoff. And it's been shown again in a number of studies, which I'm not going to go over here, is that if you make this kind of elastic network, you can reproduce atomic level fluctuations, meaning B factors from X-ray crystallography, quite well with a single scaling parameter that simply scales the curve of the atomic B factors up or down. That's the same thing as setting the value of this force constant, which we typically take as 1. Moreover, the modes that one sees, the lowest frequency modes, appear to correspond to functionally important motions. And what's also of interest and important is that within a range of actually a relatively large range of use of these cutoffs for this network connections, the results are very insensitive to the value that you use. And so rules of thumb can be developed about what size of cutoffs you should use for various kinds of representations. So this gets us around the problem of minimization, but not necessarily the problem of the size of the Hessian that we still have to diagonalize. Still, if we do a fully atomic elastic network, it has 3n by 3n dimensions. So there are two approaches that we can use to address that problem. One is the coarse graining I've already mentioned, but the other is the use of the rotation translation block method that Florence Tama worked on as a graduate student and brought to this approach in 2000. And the idea here is that oftentimes, residues move as rigid units, or parts of the structure move as a rigid unit. And consequently, we don't need to consider the detailed fluctuations within that unit. We can consider that whole unit effectively as a rigid rotation translation block, construct the normal modes based on this rotation translation block Hessian, which reduces the size significantly. So this brings into range very, very large systems. In the context of viruses, just to foreshadow a little bit, we typically can consider these blocks to be the proteins that comprise the asymmetric unit. So for a T=3 virus, a T=4 virus like N omega V that I know Jack Johnson spoke about last night, there are four proteins per asymmetric unit, or four of these blocks. We still have all of the detail, if we've done it, say, with a C-alpha representation, of the connectivity between the individual proteins in this case, or domains if one's doing this at the level of domains. But, oops, I'm not talking fast enough, am I? But in fact, we've simplified the problem significantly. So the kinds of values that we use for these constants, and as I said, the range or the results are relatively insensitive to this range, are this cutoff for elastic networks is about 4.5 angstroms or so if one has a fully heavy atom representation. Really 7 to 8 or 9 angstroms if one has C alpha. If one's looking at nucleic acids, in which you just use the phosphate centers, it's 10 to 12 angstroms. And if you're looking at protein and nucleic acid constructs like the ribosome, typically 10 to 12 or 10 to 15 angstroms are fine. And in a number of coarse-graining models, one sees that, or coarse-grained representations, one uses distances for these cutoffs that are 15 to 25 angstroms. What typically where this rule of thumb comes from is that if you construct your coarse-grained representation on whatever definition you choose, so every 20th residue is considered, or the center of mass of a group of atoms that are within a radius of 30 angstroms. I'm just making up things here. Or C alphas. If you look at the spatial distribution of the nearest neighbors and the second nearest neighbors, etc., about any given central site pseudoatom, you want to go to the second peak in that distribution. And that distance will well define how far you should go for defining the elastic bonds. And then a further level of coarsening, as I've already described, via the RT block method, reduces the problem even further, the computational problem, and makes it facile. So again, there have been a number of questions and systems we've been able to approach with these methods, kind of a graphic representing some of those problems are shown here. As Joachim discussed, on Sunday evening, we were privileged to work and collaborate with him on exploring questions about the ribosome motions associated with translocation, and he described that very nicely. I won't sort of talk about that again. We've been able to collaborate and continue to collaborate with Ken Taylor on interpreting some of the motions associated with myosin II inhibition, which involve, in fact, movement from what's a putative starting structure, there's no real structure for that initial state, and distortions down to known inhibited structures. And our function and our purpose and interest there was interpreting what happens at the sort of head S2 junction when this transformation takes place, as well as some other things in terms of fitting these structures into EM tomographic data that I'll talk about a little bit later. There's been a lot of work on transitions associated with functional motions in enzymes like RNA polymerase, which again I'm not going to talk about, but there are examples of using these methods. And then in virus maturation, and I'm going to say a little bit about virus maturation and maybe build on some of the things which Jack talked about last night. And so here these are transitions of really quite large systems which involve significant reorganization not only of the size of the structure, but reorganization of the proteins within the asymmetric unit, this being HK97, which is a T equals 7 virus, 7 proteins in the asymmetric unit. And as you heard last night, I think that there's significant chemistry that happens here. And I should, again, provide the sort of disclaimer, we don't really talk about the chemistry. We can't say anything about the details of the chemistry that happens with this level of model. So let me talk about the kinds of things that we can learn with these elastic network normal mode calculations on viral capsids, and focus a little bit on three systems that we've studied. CCMV, which is a T equal 3 viral capsid, which undergoes a swelling transition that's been characterized at atomic resolution in this end and by EM data at this end. N omega V, another structure which undergoes an acid-induced swelling transition. And HK97, which again I think you heard about last night. So one of the questions that we were very interested in is, you know, what motions, what collective motions of these large objects drive the transitions from unswollen states to swollen states? Are there differences as we increase the complexity of the viral capsid in these instances between the transitions? Do we need more information to describe transitions in more complex T equals 7 viral capsids than we do to describe it in T equal 3 or T equal 4 capsids like CCMV or N omega V? So those are the kinds of issues that Florence was interested in addressing using these kinds of approaches. And so basically, for these calculations, the coarse graining was done at the C alpha level to construct the elastic network model. So C alphas from the entire capsid of each of the proteins was used to represent the underlying elastic model. And then the diagonalization was done using this rotation translation block approach, in which a single protein represented a single block. So for the case of T equal 3 capsids, you know, this is a relatively modest normal mode problem, 1080 by 1080. For T equals 13, which are very large structures with probably, well, approaching or over a million atoms in them, so it's 3 million by 3 million if we wanted to treat it at fully atomic level of detail, you know, we're talking about a 5,000 by 5,000 problem. And it's really this multi-scale, multi-resolution ability that allows us to address these kinds of questions. Again, with the caveat that if there are significant reorganizations that take place, we need to do other things to account for those. All right, so what do we find? And what do we look for with respect to these kinds of transitions? So in CCMV, we have, as I said, this is the example shown here, CCMV, the X-ray structure at moderately high resolution, and a model which we fit in using NMFF, this normal mode flexible fitting approach, which I'll talk a little bit about later on, into a swollen structure. And so the question is, if we're looking at this swelling transition, how many collective variables do we need to describe the transition? And that's what's shown here. I should also say that and this is maybe a technical detail, is that if we're looking at a transition between two structures which have, in this case, icosahedral symmetry, our normal modes represent all of the possible distortions that this structure could undergo. So squishing it up like, you know, an egg-shaped object or doing all sorts of weird things, all of those are represented in principle. However, the only ones which will provide you with any progress along this coordinate are those that overlap and those that obey icosahedral symmetry. And that is, in this case, the highest symmetry that's available to these objects, these molecular structures. So that tells us we should only look for... Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me. You said that each capsid protein was
Each protein in the asymmetric unit.
It seemed to me when the virus expands from the native to the
swollen state.
There was some kind of rearrangement inside of the capsin protein. Doesn't the protein itself expand and rearrange?
Well, I mean, in some instances, we know that that does happen. And for HK97, we looked at models where we took, there's this lever that Jack talked about last night, okay, and it's got a flexible point. We made models instead that each protein in the T equals 7 capsid was represented by now 2 blocks or 3 blocks or 10 blocks, et cetera. And the observations are, and these are in the paper which is referenced here somewhere, that the gross motions that describe the swelling itself are represented quite well, picking individual proteins as a rigid block. As you dress things or as you make them slightly lower resolution by adding, higher resolution by adding more fragments, you can in principle improve your description of the model, but at some point, and I think this was the point Nels was making about, at some point the data doesn't justify making the model more sophisticated. So I'm going to talk at this point about single blocks per protein in the asymmetric unit. However, the methodology is in fact goes all the way to single atoms. And so one can look at all of those levels. You just complicate the issue somewhat more. So anyways, so for CCMV, what we're looking at here is the degree to which any given mode, this is this collective motion, overlaps with the direction of the transition between these two states. And what we find is that there's a single mode, mode number 24, if we're going from the unswollen state to the swollen state, it happens to be mode number 28, if we're coming from the swollen state back to the unswollen state. A single mode accounts for more than 90% of the transition. Okay, it overlaps with this displacement vector by 90%. And then another mode, number 88, amounts to another 1 or 2%, and then as you keep going up in the spectrum, higher in energy, more local in the displacement, you will eventually recover all of the description of that displacement. However, what's key here is that one mode here basically describes the transition of swelling. For N omega V, slightly more complex capsid, T equals 4. So these say non-degenerate modes because, as I pointed out, and this doesn't start from mode 1, because as I pointed out, only a certain number of modes obey the degeneracy or obey the symmetry of the particle, the icosahedral symmetry. And those modes, because this is the highest symmetry of this particle, are the non-degenerate sets of modes. That's a technical detail probably that we don't need to be concerned with so much here. So anyways, again, in N omega V, for the swelling direction, from unswollen to swelling, again, a single mode is mode number 24, amounts for about 90%+ of the transition. If we go in the other direction, and we see this sometimes, going from a swollen state to an unswollen state, that a few more modes are responsible, but basically, it's a single mode which represents most of the transition. Yeah?
But so within the icosahedral symmetry, these are the lowest modes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's like the first three or the first two?
Icosahedral modes, that's correct, yeah. For HK97, however, we see that the lowest icosahedral mode, 40 or 47, depending on which direction we're going, really only describes about 65% of the reorganization that has to take place in order for the structure to go to its mature head 2 state, from a pro head 2 state. And then another mode, mode 80 or 72, or maybe it's 60, I can't read it from here, describes the remaining 40% approximately. So as these capsids get more complex in their organization of the proteins in the asymmetric unit, more modes are required to describe the transition. This just illustrates The nature of the displacement of the atoms, these are actually residue numbers down here, for the swelling of CCMV by that single mode, whether we're going in the forward direction, I think, which is red, or the backward direction is blue, it describes a displacement of about 22 angstroms or so. Experimentally, that displacement is about 22 angstroms, 21.7. For N omega V, that lowest icosahedral mode describes a displacement of about 23 to 24 angstroms, or 23 to 25. Experimentally, it's about 25 angstroms. So again, the lowest frequency mode here captures the bulk of that that transformation. Go ahead. We're actually projecting onto this displacement vector in this case. And so the phase is the one which increases the radius of the particle. Yeah. For HK97, as I've already pointed out, two modes are responsible for the motion. The lowest frequency mode, or the lowest icosahedral mode, mode 1, displaces all of the sets of residues except those that are involved in the five-fold symmetry axis. So this predominantly is a displacement of all of the hexamers that comprise the T equals 7 capsid. The other mode displaces predominantly the pentameric regions of the structure. And we've seen quite generally that I'm going to summarize that later, but oftentimes a single mode is responsible for moving the pentameric parts, and that may have functional significance with regards to viral life cycles. So this illustrates mode 1, and you see it's predominantly sort of swelling of these regions involving the hexamers, and you see mode 2, and that's predominantly the bulging of these five-fold symmetry modes. And again, this virus, in terms of its maturation process, undergoes two kinds of transitions. It, of course, swells. It undergoes a swelling transition. And you heard about that swelling transition involves the formation of these chainmail links between lysine and asparagine or glutamine residues. I've forgotten now which. But it also undergoes a physical transition from a spherical type object to one which is faceted. And it's this faceting, or the requirement for this faceting, which probably is functional in the context of this viral capsid, that separates these two modes to both being important. So one, to make the facets, i.e. to bulge out those five-fold symmetry axes, and one, to do the sort of overall expansion of the structure. So just to summarize this and move on to sort of what is the interesting or more interesting part is that, so for HK97 we found that a pair of low frequency icosahedral normal modes are necessary to produce the non-uniform conformational transition. In the simpler viral capsids like N omega V and CCMV, a single mode seems to describe the swelling. I should say that we've also analyzed, and this gets to some of the other questions, that for both of these instances, there's sort of the swelling process, which really just moves the proteins out. But in addition, the proteins reorganize with respect to one another, tilt and twist with respect to one another, and it's typically the higher frequency icosahedral modes that describe that kind of rearrangement of the protein-protein interfaces. And similarly, if we had a more detailed model as we've looked at in HK97, the motion of the loop is in fact involved in higher frequency modes. This is why the lowest frequency modes appear to be justified in terms of describing the gross aspects of the swelling process. The capsid shell is not necessarily mechanically uniform, especially for viruses of higher complexity. And as I noted, for these viruses of higher complexity, it's typically the case. And I should say that when I'm saying typically the case, Florence looked at basically a large number of viral capsids and explored what the nature of the swelling modes and the swelling transition would be, some of which there have been identified swelling transitions, but maybe not structurally characterized, others of which it's really a speculation asking what would happen if this thing swelled. And from that, we see that typically pentameric units display higher flexibility in these modes that are involved in swelling, and that may be involved and important for the functional aspects of these viruses. All right, so now I want to talk about, you know, sort of the transformation of this, you know, theoretical tool for exploring the nature of motions in these large assemblies and macromolecular machines to the sort of practical tool of using this for refinement of lower resolution atomic structures into lower resolution data, such as that from cryo-EM. Again, normal mode flexible fitting for fitting these models, atomic models, into cryo-EM data. So the basic idea you probably should already have. We have a small number of very collective degrees of freedom, the normal modes. We'd like to take a model, an atomic model that has a one shape, and fit it into a functionally characterized but at lower resolution representation of that model, which has a different shape. And as I've already commented, by using the low-frequency normal modes, we believe we're representing functionally relevant motions of the structure. And we're really moving a very small number of degrees of freedom. There are really very small number of parameters that we're exploring to fit this structure into the atomic density. And so we do use a real space refinement approach. NMFF uses a real space refinement approach based on the correlation coefficient. And the idea is to pick some initial atomic model, fit it either by hand or using some of the rigid body techniques into the density initially, and then pick a small subset of modes, fewer than 10 typically, to try to reorganize this structure to optimize the correlation coefficient. And in the process of this reorganization, as we distort the structure away from its initial atomic representation, we have to reconstruct new elastic networks that describe the connectivity of the deformed structure, and then re-diagonalize, calculate the normal modes for this deformed structure, and then search along those normal modes. And this kind of describes the algorithm that's used to do that. Really, all you need to know is that we're optimizing the correlation coefficient with respect to a relatively small number of degrees of freedom, less than 10 typically. So the search space comprises small number of degrees of freedom. So this reduces, I think, the potential for overfitting. And the search occurs in these very collective coordinates, which are, quote, the natural motions, and consequently issues associated with, you know, moving two domains independently because of segmentation types of approaches are minimized, okay, are less likely to occur. So the idea here is that we want to move, so this, if this is sort of the correlation coefficient, you know, as a function of displacement along two of the modes, we'd like to move from some initial position to a position which maximizes the correlation coefficient. And that can be posed in many ways. We've posed it in the context of an optimization problem and used standard gradient-based algorithms to search along those normal modes for the directions which optimize the correlation coefficient, which increase the overlap between the computed density for our model structure and our experimental density. So we compute the gradient of the correlation coefficient with respect to our normal modes. This is something like a force. Based on the magnitude of this gradient, we pick directions to distort the structure, typically within a space of a few, less than 10 of these modes. And we follow via steepest descent algorithm this optimization, maximization in this case, direction. Now, we've also implemented Hessian approaches where we look at more detail of the energy or sorry, the sort of landscape of correlation coefficient as a function of normal modes. This is more costly, and in many instances it's not necessary for refinement of the structure, but we've implemented this anyway. So this just illustrates sort of what a given iteration looks like here. We have some initial atomic level model. We construct the elastic network normal modes, and we look at all of the subset of modes, the first 10 lowest modes or something like that, and we look at how the magnitude of the correlation coefficient changes as a function of which mode we're looking at, and then we pick off those that provide the largest displacement and the largest gradient. So we move in the direction that the gradient most changes the correlation coefficient. And what this illustrates is how modes overlap with the displacement vector between these two structures, that's the black line, and how these corresponding gradients correspond to those optimal directions for motion. And so by picking the largest gradients, we're basically picking the modes which overlap greatest with the displacement that will optimize the correlation coefficient. So that's basically, in a nutshell, how the approach works. We've sort of tested it on a number of cases, and you know, I'm not going to go in detail that this is already published work from a few years ago. Sort of these are all atomic level, or these are all sort of molecular structures. They don't involve significant complexes. This kind of just illustrates the refinement of one of those models. This is the elongation factor G bound to the ribosome from data sort of given to us by Joachim Frank as an illustration. This shows, well, this was showing the course of the refinement. Ah, wrong way. So you see, I don't know why it's not wiggling for me. That doesn't matter. It fits in now, right? It didn't fit in initially. This shows, in fact, the course of the refinement. And as we go a number of iterations, and an iteration here is calculating the normal modes, moving along those modes that have the greatest gradient, recalculating the normal modes, moving along those, etc. And you see how the correlation coefficient increases, in this case, to something from a very low correlation coefficient to something that's quite high, I guess, 0.66 to about 0.83 or 84. Well, the structure itself is being distorted or moved away from in RMSD, atomic level RMSD, by some 10 angstroms or so from its starting position. Okay. So again, this is accomplished, and I want to stress this, in the subspace of fewer than 10 degrees of freedom. Okay. So I want to kind of finish up by just talking about some of the problems that we've been able to work on, and some of them I'm really not going to talk about because they've already been talked about here. Joachim again described the work that Florence and he and his collaborators carried out on the ribosome connected to SecY. And illustrated again the strength and utility of using this flexible fitting algorithm in this case to deduce feasibility of one model over another model with regards to the structure of SecY. Another instance which grew out of our interactions that were initiated here involved GROEL. This is really kind of an interesting case because, of course, there have been very little, well, a lot of work done on GROEL, but in no other instance aside from this, this was the first instance in which we had a real substrate molecule bound to the GROEL complex. And so the question was, how does GROEL distort from its X-ray structure in order to accommodate the substrate, which in this case is glutamine synthetase. I think that's right. Is that right? Go ahead.
What was the RMSD here between the two conformations?
Do I remember this number?
Oh, about
Probably on the order of 8 or 10 angstroms. Yeah.
Because I thought that this method was very useful for very large conformations, yeah. And I'm quite surprised to see very small rearrangements here.
Well, again, I mean, I think that this is 8 or 10 angstroms is not that small of a rearrangement, but okay,
but
yeah. It doesn't look that big, right. I guess some residues move by 7 angstroms, so that's... all right. So what was interesting that came out of this is that sort of GroEL can be cartoon characterized in this kind of fashion. And it had been known from high-resolution structural studies as well as a number of EM studies, cryo-EM studies, that when ATP binds to the GroEL and GroES then forms a complex with this, there's this what has been interpreted as the classic transition for this chaperonin of exposing or hiding hydrophobic or polar groups depending upon whether ATP and GroES were present or not. However, when glutamine synthetase, and this has a corresponding set of structural motions, reorganizations that were interpreted functionally and thought to be attributable to how GroEL, GroES functions in the presence of substrate. So an interesting observation that came out of these calculations and fitting atomic level models from this crystal structure into the EM data with glutamine synthetase bound was that the motions in some sense appear to be in the opposite direction from those inferred based on substrate absent structures of the GroEL, GroES complexes. So new ideas really, I think, emerged from fitting of these structures to the EM data. I think another problem which we've been working on in collaboration with Alok Mitra involves so fitting of lethal factor into a new structure of the anthrax toxin complex. And again, there's sort of reorganization and most importantly a sort of shrinking of this lethal factor in the presence of the protective antigen heptamer. And it's thought that functionally the reason this thing shrinks is because it needs to fit through that hole, basically. So again, another example which is sort of still work in progress. And then also recently with Tim Baker and his collaborators, we've been looking at the red clover neurotic mosaic virus and how this virus responds to basically having the calcium leached out of it by EDTA. And I think Tim had atomic level structures of... Am I right about this, Tim?
Yes.
Atomic level structures of the sort of calcium intact virus and EM data for the non-intact, although it was for... Tim, you need to... For tomato bushy stunt, which was a homolog. And we built a homology model, or Tim and his coworkers, I think, built a homology model, and then we fit that homology model into the EM density. And what's being shown here is sort of the reorganization of the protein units as a function of moving from the high-resolution structure to accommodate the EM structure. And I guess a last example, which is ongoing with Ken Taylor, involves sort of the fitting of inhibited HMM into... tomographic data, and here, in fact, this is a great deal of extrapolation, if you will, because the density that really defines this tail is relatively minimal. Nevertheless, we're using a really small number of degrees of freedom, 4 or 5 degrees of freedom, to try to ask how this structure distorts to fit in to the density. All right. So what I've tried to illustrate here is that NMFF uses a small number of collective and functionally relevant, we believe, independent coordinates to optimize the correlation coefficient, and this likely minimizes issues with regards to overfitting. One can use multiple levels of coarse graining for optimizing the model and accommodating. It should be data, not date, sorry. We can employ symmetry and allow symmetric assemblies to be modeled from their asymmetric unit. And NMFF is, in fact, free and available at that site if you want to get it. So summarizing the first part, the elastic network methodology sort of allows us a means to explore the natural motions of biological molecules, and the point which Yoko made earlier, that it appears that nature exploits, from looking at many of these instances, exploits the overall shape of her biological machines to achieve robustness of the functional reorganization, and then decorates these shapes to do the chemistry and to do other aspects of regulation, et cetera, that are required. And this is why these kinds of normal mode methods appear to be very useful in capturing functional motion, because these motions are really just determined by the overall shape. So NMFF, the normal mode flexible fitting, can be used in conjunction with known atomic level structures and lower resolution data from cryo-AM and related low resolution methods. And I've tried to illustrate that by a number of cases where we have ongoing collaborations. And I should really thank all of the people who have been involved in collaborating with us, guiding us in sort of what's useful and what's not. I mentioned a few of them here. The key one really is Florence Tama, who really developed all of these and is now starting an independent career at University of Arizona, together with her now husband, Osamu Miyashita, who was involved also in the development of NMFF. Both of them are now faculty at University of Arizona. Michael Feig, who was involved in developing something I didn't talk about, the MMTSB tool set, which is a general set of tools for manipulating atomic level structures and interfacing to programs like CHARM and AMBER, Jack Johnson and VJ Reddy for their sort of input on a number of the virus structures and questions that we looked at, Joachim Frank, Alok Mitra, Mark Fisher, Ed Gogol, for their sort of letting us be involved in collaborating on very interesting and important problems, and again learning more about how to do these things, and then Tim Baker as well for involvement in the viral capsids, and I guess I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Time for a couple of questions, I think.
Okay.
Do you have any quote-unquote energy measures for these transformations?
Well,
have you done any MD simulations on the side or something like that to quantify what kind of energy it would take for that to happen?
So the simple answer is we haven't in a lot of detail done this. The more complete answer is that I just want to illustrate where we're talking. So I have a number of tutorials put together for NMFF that kind of illustrate how to use it, and they're on our website. So the other answer is that we do and can analyze how much stress or tension is induced due to these conformational changes as we progress towards whatever the endpoint functional state is. And in that way, we can localize where stress occurs and where it doesn't occur. And putting an energetic sort of number on that, could very well be important for understanding things. So far, we've simply said, when one looks at where the stress is induced and what are the stress points, you can often understand in a qualitative reason, why particular functional domains are where they are because of their requirement for relieving or taking up this stress and so forth. And in the case of the myosin inhibition, in fact, we were able to rationalize why, for example, the S2, where the S2 domain fuses or connects to the head domain, has this region of uncoiled coil-coil that's on the order of 2 to 3 heptads of coil-coil repeat uncoiled, and that if you put them fully coiled up to the head S2 junction, in fact, you built huge amounts of stress and you were unable to find motions that transmitted that stress down to the tail, the S2 domain. And similarly, if you put them too long, or if you put random coil, or you just put extended peptide connecting those, as occurs in kinesin, you also were not able to transmit, if you will, the stress down into the chain. And so functionally, the reason it's 2 or 3 appears to be that it needs to be able to transmit stress down into the rest of the chain. So one can learn things like that, although that's not a detailed energetic answer. Yeah. Well, so, you know, in all of the examples that we've looked at, we're assuming that the structures are comprised of the same sets of atoms. Obviously, if we have more atoms than we started with or fewer atoms than we started with, we're not dealing with that explicitly. Yeah.
In the CCMV swelling and the HK97 swelling, it looks like there's no hysteresis in your normal log, but in NAMIGA-B,
right.
Is that functional? I mean, is that real? Should we believe that these things are not going by the same path?
Personally, I think that that's overfitting. I think that that's trying to push the data too far. I mean, I think one could use this as a way to kind of move on to ask deeper questions like that, but we haven't done so, and I'm sort of hesitant to say, yeah. Niels, do you want
to? I'm going to have to stop here, I think, because...
I just need to point one thing out. I didn't want to do it during the talk, but I think it's important to know that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the number of volts you use and the degrees of freedom that you're producing within the system. Because if you just think of introducing a really high-frequency mode, you'll have everything wiggling like hell.
I don't quite, I mean, either I don't agree or I don't understand with the comment. The fact is that transformation is an identity transformation. The number of modes are the number of degrees of freedom. It's exact.
So the degrees of freedom you introduce into your fitting problem are depending on the movement of the atoms, not on what number of modes you introduce. So you will have to convert the motion that you introduce into your through your normal modes into the degrees of freedom that you introduce into the atomic system. So if I remember correctly, there's the trivial mode is doing what?
The what? Sorry.
The trivial normal mode.
Well, there are 6 modes that describe the overall rotation and translation of the object, which are all 0 frequency. Yes. Yeah. But those are not included typically. Yeah. I mean, I think that's not correct. There's one parameter per mode that's being fit, that's being adjusted.
Yes, but
that parameter happens to move a lot. Well, in the same way that as you rotate rigidly and translate, the same argument would say that the number of parameters that you're using are the number of atoms that you have because you're moving all of them.
Yes, but you move them together. So the correlation coefficient
only
depends on...
And that's what Q does. The Q variables are all of the atoms moving together.
All right, I've got to stop this. Both of you guys, I think, are available to coffee, and maybe we can continue this discussion there.